I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. My guest today is Patrick LeBrun. Patrick, welcome back.
Yes, thanks for having me.
So today we're going to talk about the recent elections in France, and we're also going to sort of roll history back a few years to the beginning of Marine Le Pen's career, and also her niece, Marion Maréchal Le Pen's political careers. So we have some context. So let's begin, though, with the elections. Just give us sort of a summary of what happened.
So the number of regions was reduced from, in metropolitan France, which means mainland France, was reduced from, I think it was 22 to now 12. And of those, in six regions, the FN was the leading party. And in fact, in Normandy, they came within, I think it was 0.2%. of being the number one party. So it was a really, really close one in Normandy.
What are regions in France, first of all? Are those analogous to states or provinces? What are they exactly?
Yeah, so for the regions, so they're the base level for politics would be the municipals. Then you have departments and then regions. Cantons are kind of being finished off through some reforms going on right now. And then you have the national level after the regional. So the regions would be in charge of, subventions would be supporting sports associations, running high schools. So they don't run the education materials that they have, but they just decide who gets how much money for what, who needs new buildings, these kinds of things. They help university and research groups to coordinate across a region so that they don't compete with each other. So you have kind of different specialists within the same region who are complementary rather than competing. Work on a lot of development of apprentices and kind of working class jobs that are high skilled blue collar jobs, right? Like the kind of school that you go to for that, that's all run by the regions. And then, of course, all of the non-urban transport, all of the, above the urban level, running of, taking out the trash, these kinds of things. So it's, it's kind of like, just basic governing stuff. There's very little ideology that enters into it in many ways. It's just deciding how you cut the cake.
Right, right. So it sounds a lot more like local government than a U.S. state or a province in Canada, for instance.
Right, it does, yeah. And I'd say also that this is the level of government where you see people concerned with rural issues the most, promoting, let's say, creating a kind of brand around a regional product. Our local product would be done on this level. So that's the what's called the desertification of rural areas is a big issue right now for these people who live far from the cities. And it's something that this government is very poor on because they're very, very urban focused and very focused on creating, a handful of hubs, urban hubs around the country and emptying out the countryside. It's just not where they're interested in having any development. They're not interested in keeping people close to their families and their traditional jobs and making a living where they were born.
So the first round of the elections were really good for the Front National. They came in first in six regions.
Right.
And then this past Sunday, of course, the final round happened, and they did not come in first in any of these regions, as I understand.
Right.
What happened?
The main thing that happened is that in two of the regions, the Socialist Party dropped out completely from a three-way race. And so what's different about this election than some of the others is that it's possible to have three parties qualify for the second round. And so, when you go to vote in France, you walk by a table. It's very different from America, actually. You walk by a table and you have a stack of cards and you have a card from each party. And you have an envelope and you take a card into a, or several cards, if you want to, you know, hide who you prefer. You walk into this curtain drawn closet. You put one of them into the envelope. And if you have any others you brought with you, you toss them in the trash. And then you walk out and they watch you put the single envelope into a clear plastic box. Very quick and easy, right? And so the first time around, you might have seven different parties for a regional election. And then the second time around, you'll have two or three, as long as no one got more than 50% of the vote in the first round. And so in everywhere in the metropolitan France, it was a triangular race. And so where the Socialist Party was in third place in two of these, where Marine Le Pen and Marion Maréchal Le Pen were, and that's the north, the Calais region, and in the southeast, they dropped out completely. And so that meant that, you know, there was a Republican front of left and right united to stop the FN. And then in the others, you know, they scored in the first place, but they scored in the first place with only 36 or 38% of the vote. And so, they weren't able to get up beyond, you know, when all the, especially the very divided left united, they were able to win the election in that, locality. Cause you have, you know, the Socialist Party, but then you also have the Communist Party, you have the Greens, you have several others.
So basically, the establishment revealed that there are things more important to them than principles, their own principles, and that is namely stopping nationalism from going forward. So the socialists basically said, screw socialism, vote for Sarkozy, because it's more important to keep nationalists out of power than it is to pursue socialist policies.
Exactly, exactly. And that's something that you hear in the discourse of Marine Le Pen, Marion Maréchal Le Pen, and François Philippot in their three concession speeches. Every single one of them mentioned that there are only two choices in France, and that is either you're a globalist or you're a patriot.
Do you think that the Front National can ever win an outright election in France, and what would have to happen for that to take place?
I do think it's possible. It would be very difficult. Basically all of the, everything has to fall in the right direction for this to win. You'd need a divided right, a united left in the first round, and then it might be possible, in the presidential election. In terms of all these other localities, you know, I mean, it may be, you know, over the next 20 years, you'll see more FN victories. But what really matters to me is stopping the replacement of our people and maintaining a majority in our own countries. And so, you know, I feel like 2017 is really the key moment. And I think that only a president can stop this under the French Constitution. And so because the French president has the power to ask the people directly through referenda to change laws and can go all the way around the legislature, there's no need to have a majority in the legislature to do this. And if we have to wait until 2022, I think it's too late. And in fact, Jean-Marie Le Pen even spoke today on television saying that, we'll end up with a President Mustafa, just like Michel Houellebecq said.
Right.
Elect his daughter next time around.
So when in 2017 is the presidential election? What month?
Most likely it will be in May, unless the president decides to step aside and hold an early election.
So basically 18 months, 17 months from now.
Yeah. And so, you know, not to be overly dramatic, but I really believe that we have 17 months to decide if we're going to resolve this issue peacefully and then through the electoral process. And if we don't, then I see nothing other than taking to the streets that can solve the problem.
Right. Well, at that point, we can look back at France's long history of revolutions and coups and troubles and hope that this time it actually would break in favor of saving the French, saving them from themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And expelling the horrible people who are helping this happen. And frankly, I think that they deserve whatever comes to them, the people who have put this system in place. And it's hard to imagine you just like watching you know, watching a film about the French Revolution and seeing the hatred they felt for these aristocrats and royals and putting them under the guillotine. But I think that if we have to wait much longer, and I think that we'll understand completely how they felt.
France in 1789 went from a monarchy to the First Republic. The First Republic gave way to Napoleon's dictatorship. Yeah. Then there was the First Empire. Then there was the restoration of the monarchy. Then Napoleon came back. Then the monarchy was restored again. Then in 1830, there was a revolution that brought in another monarchy. In 1848, that monarchy was thrown out in a revolution. You had another republic. You had a dictator, again, another Bonaparte. Then the Second Empire. Then the collapse of the Second Empire, then the Paris Commune, the Third Republic. The Third Republic was almost overthrown by the right in, what was it, 1934 or 1935?
I'd have to look back at my dates, but yeah, it was a... If people know Paris, if they know the Cleopatra's Needle, it was basically a riot of people like us. And they almost... And it's right across the river from the National Assembly, and they almost dropped the government.
Yeah. Then, of course, there was the defeat in 1940. There was the National Revolution. Again, there was a restoration of the Third Republic. Then the Third Republic gave way to the Fourth and the Fifth Republic.
Yeah.
They've gone through three republics since the end of the Second World War. And I think that if Marine Le Pen is locked out, she should just basically start running under the banner of let's have a sixth and final republic.
Yeah.
And just put an end to all of this. Because... let's just be honest. The reason why the French, why French democracy is being constantly overthrown is that it doesn't work. The country gets hostage to these pusillanimous parties that would rather destroy the nation than give up any of their little preferments and set aside their silly illusions. And that's when you need a coup.
Right? Absolutely. Yeah. You know, life-changing epiphanies that I've had was when I was watching an interview with Pervez Musharraf, of all people, former general and president of Pakistan. And it was after he was out of office, and there was talk about putting him before a Pakistani court. And charging him with something or other, I don't know what. And it was, you know, one of these, I don't know if it was Christian Amanpour, but it was one of these idiot, you know, international correspondents from CNN talking to him. And she said something about his dictatorship or totalitarianism or something like this. And he stopped her. He's like, hold on. He said, I ran a temporary caretaker government because we're in a nuclear standoff with our oldest enemy, with whom we've had three wars over the last half century. On the other side, a war was beginning where the world's superpower was getting engaged. And then on the other side, we have a country on the verge of becoming a nuclear power as well, which has strong ideological differences with us, with whom we share the same separatist tribe along our border, Balochistan, you know, the Balochis of Balochistan. And within my own country, we were on the verge of civil war with the Lal Masjid and with radical Islamists, taking to the streets in a number of the cities and engaging in, you know, serious violence. And so we had a temporary caretaker government. And when the crisis passed, we had an election. And when I lost an election, I stepped down. And this concept of temporary caretaker government, it's not something you learn about in civics class, but it really is in the long life of a nation, in the true sense, not in the sense of a constitutional republic, in the sense of a people, there comes a time when you need temporary caretaker governments. And I think we're on the verge of that now. And if 2017 isn't the year for Marine Le Pen, then it will be the time, across the West. For temporary caretaker governments.
Yeah. I've been recently reading Carl Schmitt's book, Dictatorship, where he talks about the history of the idea of dictatorship. And of course, for the Romans, that's what a dictatorship was. It was basically a temporary system in which, in order to save the republic, the regular procedures and laws of the republic had to be suspended because they weren't working anymore. And there's a long history of that in the West, and it's very different from things like presidents for life or totalitarianism, things like that, because there is the sense that it is by its nature, temporary, and it exists in service of the laws.
Right.
Sometimes you have to lull the laws to sleep in order to preserve them in a crisis.
So was there a system that they had where they would say, where they would have a way of agreeing on who they chose as dictator or the right time to set up a dictatorship in Rome?
Yeah. An example of how I think the United States system is drifting in the direction of dictatorship was the Base Closings Commission. We had a situation where, because of the pork barrel system in America, it was impossible for the legislature to close needless military bases, right? And so the legislature basically created this blue ribbon commission to take away its responsibility,
yeah,
right, and make decisions for them so that they could do this with clean hands and they didn't have to basically engage in representative politics as usual, which had been deadlocked on this issue. And so this is the kind of thing that happened in Rome. There was a sense that, well, the system cannot move forward with pluralism anymore. We are in a state of emergency. We need a strong man who can basically make decisions without having to get the approval of the Senate. And this has a built-in sunset clause, namely when the crisis is over or when a particular period of time has passed, he has to step down. Sulla was the last great Roman dictator. Of course, the very last Roman dictator was Caesar, and he didn't want to give up power. And it didn't work out well for him, but it didn't work out well for the Republic either. It was basically the end of the Republic.
Yeah, yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I guess that brings us, maybe this, we'll talk about this towards the end of the podcast, but when I think about the Trump phenomenon, you know, he's saying a lot of the right things, but, you know, I think that a lot of people in our milieu have been saying, you know, whether they like everything Putin does or not, they say we need Putin-style leadership.
Right.
And, you know, you can look to other characters in the past, you know, like Napoleon was the first you mentioned. You know, Putin was the chief of intelligence. Napoleon was, you know, a military leader. And in between, we can find people who were the heads of militias attached to unions like Mussolini, others who were heads of, had, you know, serious military experience that was respected. But not, you know, running a real estate empire and then a wildly popular TV show, right? That's not the same.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, I'm sure there are a lot of great things he can do, and I think he's got, you know, the pulse of the, what they call in the 60s and 70s, the hard hats. But yeah, I don't see how that translates into the kind of leadership that's necessary. Where do you think such a dictator can be found?
In America? Oh, I don't know. I honestly don't know. America is so bourgeois through and through. And, I mean, Trump really is bourgeois through and through. He's a businessman and a media personality.
Yeah.
He doesn't have leadership experience in the political or military realm. He does have it in the business realm. And that's how he sees the world. He sees the world through the lens of business experience. And he's an oligarch.
Yeah.
But he does have a certain populist sensibility. He does have a sense of socially conservative populism,
yeah,
which I think is the most, it's the winningest sort of platform for Americans. And if he can move forward on that, I think that would be great. In the United States, I just don't know who, except maybe somebody who would be sort of like a colonel, a military colonel. You know, it's a very interesting phenomenon, colonels' coups. I've been actually reading about them.
Right.
I honestly think that, you know, generals generally are, they're of the system.
Right.
They want the system to be preserved. And if the system is being destroyed, say, in the Spanish Civil War or whatever, that's when you would expect generals to come forward to save it. But when you have a revolution launched from the military, it generally comes from middle management. It
right.
doesn't come from the top.
Like Greece, like Gaddafi.
And of course, they generally have been bad because they've been left-wing. You know, middle management has power. People below middle management don't have the power to change things. The people in the upper tiers are totally co-opted. it's really in the middle where I think that you have the correct combination of power and fluidity of opinion and fluidity of allegiance.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and in the United States as well, every flag rank officer, every general and admiral, they have to be approved by the Congress. And so that's essentially a political correctness stopgap measure that they have in place.
Right.
And so, you know, people who do have unpopular or politically incorrect opinions who are at the colonel level, or one rank below, if they let it slip in their previous 25 years in the military, then they just will not be allowed to go any further.
Exactly. Exactly. It is highly politicized to become a general or an admiral in the United States.
Yeah. Which is why, and especially, I don't know when it started. I think in the 90s though, having the opinion that women should be frontline combatants would give a colonel a leg up for becoming a general over the majority of his colleagues he was competing against who would hold the traditional view. This is under the Clinton administration I'm talking about.
Right.
Yeah. And now, of course, there's the, openly homosexual serving. I don't know if they probably have a word for it, but I think this was another litmus test that's in place in the Obama administration.
Well, let's go back to France. Marine Le Pen, let's talk a bit about Marine Le Pen. I want your sense of her character and her ideology and her commitments. She's 47 years old. She is one of three daughters of Jean-Marie Le Pen. Has she always been involved in politics, or did she go into business, or what's her career basically been?
Well, I believe she has always been by her father's side. I've seen videos from the 80s and 90s where she is present with her father when he's going on television or when he's giving a speech. She's just always been there by his side. In fact, there is one famous moment where he was about to go on a debate on television. And just before they were about to go live on air, someone whispers in their ear, Mr. Le Pen, there was a horrible accident and your wife and three daughters are in the hospital. And obviously trying to get in his head so that he can make him perform badly in the debate. And then Jean-Marie Le Pen looked out in the audience and he saw Marine Le Pen and he realized this guy's trying to mess with him. Something's up, you know. And so...
it's despicable, yeah.
It really is, yeah. I mean, but that's the kind of people who are grasping desperately to keep their power in France.
Right.
And keep the nation asleep.
Right.
But yeah, much has been made about the trying to find differences between the father and daughter. And maybe we could begin with kind of an overview of her history as the leader of the party. And kind of get a sense of where she stands on things.
Yeah, let's do that. Yeah. So when did she emerge into a leadership position?
Well, she took over being the head of the party in January of 2011. There was a vote between her and Bruno Gollnisch, who is closer to the old style FN. He's been charged a number of times for negationism, which is, doubting the official Holocaust narrative. He's a professor, he's a professor of Japanese. I know he speaks Japanese fluently and he's married to a Japanese woman. And he is a, based in the south of France. And I remember at the St. Nicholas de Chardonnay, the head of the traditionalist Catholics, church in Paris, during this period, there was a table almost every Sunday out there, for Bruno Gollnisch, registering people to vote, encouraging them to vote in this inter-party election. And in the end, he got one-third of the vote, and Marine got two-thirds of the vote. And I think that was really very much a kind of a head count. The one-third, I think, is pretty clear, gives you a pretty clear sense of how many people were traditionalist Catholics within the FN's rank and file at that point, right? Because in France, it's very rare to be a member of a party, actually. In the United States, it's very easy. You just, when you get your driver's license, you check a box and you're done. Whereas in France, you have to specifically reach out to the party or go to their office and you have to pay an annual fee to be a member. And you become a a literal card-carrying member of the party. And so it's much less common to be a party member of any party in France than in the United States. And I remember, I didn't hear this, but my wife heard it, and she told me about it afterwards, that she saw an interview with just a random person from the crowd just after the vote took place and Marine won. And the lady was saying, well, this is horrible. If she takes over the party, then she'll just try to get as many votes as possible. And which is kind of like, well, why are you involved in a political party? You know, you should be wanting to get votes and winning and then putting your policy in place. You know, there's no other reason to be involved in mass politics, right? And if you have things that where, you know, if you have policies you want to put in place where you simply can't use that route, then you need to choose another route to get the power, the policies in place. But it really is typical of the mindset, I think, of that faction in the party. And I think that they were proven wrong by the success that she's had since then. That, you know, she outdid her father immediately in the presidential election. And then actually threw the vote to Hollande because her marching orders to her voters were to vote blank. So that means like I described the voting process earlier, where you have this stack of cards from each party inside of the voting booth that you put it in the envelope. You just drop in either a blank sheet or just an empty envelope. And that's your way of kind of doing a protest vote, saying that you don't like anyone who was involved, right? And there was a record number of these votes in the last presidential election, and it was almost twice the size of the margin of victory that François Hollande had. And so his victory was thanks to Marine Le Pen telling people to not vote for either the right or the left.
Let's talk about the different blocs that make up the Front National.
Right. So the original grouping, let's say, would be the Algerian refugees. Now, when I say that at this point, I'm talking about the Europeans who left Algeria after the end of colonization. A lot of the veterans of that war with Algeria. And this was very strong in the south, right, in the southeast of the country where a lot of these people fled to. This would be rarely including the Jewish refugees who came from Algeria. But there were a very small handful who felt comfortable amongst the FN and joined them and didn't follow their, I guess you could say they're assimilationists. You know, they didn't follow their co-religionists and co-ethnics into their own little games in the center left and center right. The other pillar would be the traditionalist Catholics. Now, there are only about 500,000 of them in the country who go to the Latin Mass, which would be a shock to anyone, I think, if you saw how present they are in terms of, processions with the images of the saints, in terms of protests, in terms of, just their, the network that they've built in terms of, schools for their kids, and in terms of churches and chapels, in terms of book editing companies. I mean, they're really incredibly, incredibly engaged for being just 500,000. They punch way above their weight. And then I'd say the other pillars would be, say, those who are nostalgic for Vichy, or this was always the accusation. And I think, just to some extent, it was probably true. And others on the right. And that's changed over time. I mean, I think that the Algerian, the refugees from, the French Algeria has not always transmitted to their kids, but those people in the South are the ones who are facing the most Arab immigration. And so if you look at areas, the new FN in terms of just voters, this is where they're strongest. So when I list this, the pillars of the party, you'll notice that, racial nationalists are not a strong presence within the party. It's always been a patriotic civic nationalism. And I think it always will be. Because frankly, our views about this are very, very small minority of people share. But what's happened recently is that the identitarians have had such a big impact on the public discourse, and again, this is a, even smaller group of people, probably 2,000 active members across the country. You know, they've had an impact on the discourse, and they've pulled the FN in their direction in certain ways. But it's still against the rules to be both an identitarian and in the FN. You can't be a card-carrying FN member if you are an identitarian.
That's interesting that they have all these airlocks, as Guillaume Fay put it, between different factions on the right in France.
Yeah.
Why is that exactly?
I think that it's, you know, a lot of it probably has to do with family tradition, frankly. I think that a lot of people, you know, they, you know, what is it, 80% of people generally have the same views as their parents. And, you know, it's a much older country with, like you pointed out, I think, what, 8 different or more different forms of government in the last 2 centuries. Excuse me. And so, you know, when people look backwards and think about, you know, where do they place themselves, it's much more split into many different factions. I'd say also that, you know, it's, you know, when we approach it like ideologues and look at it this way, I think then it looks very divided. I mean, if we look at just the people who are spending, you know, 10 hours a week making banners and hanging things over highways, or, you know, knocking on doors for a political party and passing out papers at the markets and these kinds of things, you know, to these people it matters a great deal. The same is true on the left. But if you were to talk to, you know, a guy who's a baker or a butcher, right, who worries about his safety walking to work at 4 a.m. in the morning, right, you know, these distinctions don't matter to him anymore, and he'll give a thumbs up to both sides, right, to the FN and the identitarians and whoever else is going to make it, give him a safe walk to work, ensure that his kids are safe, get a good education, and have a better life than he had.
Right. So there's a generational change that's basically happening, though, in the Front National. The older generations are going to be the people who remember Algeria.
Right.
They're going to be people who remember the Second World War and Vichy.
Right.
They're going to be people like Jean-Marie Le Pen or Bruno Gollnisch who want to make negationist claims about the Holocaust and so forth. And those people are getting old and they're dying out, and the younger generations are just not as wedded to that anymore.
Right. Right.
Of course, there's, you know, the sort of the skinheads and people like that. There's always going to be factions of people on the right who are national socialists or, you know, Holocaust revisionists and things like that. But the tendency seems to be to move away from that towards some kind of civic nationalism that is more engaged with the contemporary challenges that French people face, namely being demographically replaced by non-whites, especially Muslims in their own country.
Right, yeah. I mean, I saw an interview with the leader of the Scottish Nationalist Party, and he said something, you know, very similar. They started talking to him about, it was with an American interviewing him, they started talking about, you know, Braveheart and all these things. And he said, look, you know, the only way we're going to convince people to vote for us and to vote for independence is if we can provide a better vision for the future for Scotland. And the same is true here. And, you know, we're talking about France, you know, the only way they're going to win is not by winning historical arguments. It's by providing a better vision for the future for the country.
Right, right, exactly. The battle that they need to fight is the battle for the future, not to refight the battle for Vichy.
Right, right.
Let's talk about Marianne Maréchal Le Pen. She's the granddaughter of Jean-Marie Le Pen.
Right.
She's the niece of Marine Le Pen.
Right.
She's 26 years old. She's married. She's a mother. Her base of operations, where she's really strong, is in the south of France. And who are her supporters within the party? She's somewhat different from her aunt in her right. political interests and style. So can you explain some of that?
Yeah, so she has a much stronger support from the Catholic right, from the traditionalist. You know, during the anti-gay marriage rallies, Marine Le Pen stayed home. Philippot, her number two, stayed home. A number of others stayed home, but she was very much engaged. And she was really involved when there was one protester who was beaten up actually by the police and held in jail for a while. And there might have been more cases, similar cases, but there was one in particular that was pretty serious. And she got very much involved in that. And you know, to the west of Paris in the suburbs, there are some very wealthy suburbs, including Versailles. And you have a lot of people who are, monarchist or reactionaries or, traditionalist Catholics. And they have a certain way they dress and look, and you kind of can spot them easily on the streets. And also they make up the bulk of the youth activists and the youth wing of the Front National, the FNJ. And so they were very much involved in this, the anti-gay marriage rallies. And so she drew herself very closely to these youth, which I think was, it's pretty smart, the way they did it. That she's essentially a proxy for the leader of the party on an unpopular stance, to solidify a base within the party. Because, the majority of French want to have, gay marriage. It's about 50-50 on adoption. And then also if you look at the youth, I think it's something like, it's two-thirds of the youth want gay marriage, but then I think if you took out blacks and Arabs, I think you'd see that number go up even higher. So when you're talking about appealing to new constituencies, it's better that the head doesn't go out to do this, but that you have proxies within the party. So Marion has really solidified this important pillar of activists within the Front National.
That's interesting. And Marine Le Pen is... My impression of Marine Le Pen, at least, is that she's not particularly religious and not particularly tied to conservative Catholics. Is that correct?
That's correct. And she said as such, she said something like she was very pious as a child and has a great deal of, which I think, is probably true, but it's also kind of insulting to people who are still pious, right?
Right.
And she was, she's also divorced, which I think that had a lot to do with the, opposition in the, in 2011, in fact, vote. Which is odd because her father was also divorced, but this is what I was hearing, face to face interactions with, traditionalist Catholics saying, well, why do you think, Father Beauvais is against her? And this would come up a lot, which was kind of, maybe he had another reason and that's just what he was saying, so she's definitely, she would be, not representing herself accurately if she tried to get out in front of that crowd, frankly.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, at least she's not pandering to them like an American would. I mean, that's just in the American DNA, right?
Right.
Her niece can sincerely get involved in this and sincerely canvass that particular block, and I think that's a good thing.
Yeah. There's the number two guy in the party is Florian Philippot, who I said also didn't participate. And he's actually rose very quickly within the party. He's the number two guy. He's 34 years old. And there's this other strain in French politics that was, say, slightly to the left of the FN or in between the FN and the Sarkozyist and Chiracian factions, right? The kind of conservative crowd. And these are the sovereignists. These are the people who are anti-EU. And that's where you'd find a lot of, especially in the west of France, the people who are further to the right. The Vendée, they would support this point of view. And Florian Philippot is really, he had this view when he was in university. He was active with a left-wing candidate who was against the EU, and he's always been involved in anti-EU stuff. And he brings that to the FN. And he's often pointed to as a character within the party who's anti-identitarian. And he's kind of, when previous to Marine Le Pen, Alain Soral got involved in the FN. But only for a short time. And it was really about, reaching out to the poor, forgotten whites of the ghetto, essentially. And he did a lot to change the economic case that the FN was making. Because in the early days of, Jean-Marie Le Pen, he was a Thatcherite. He'd point to Britain and say, look at the wonderful things that Margaret Thatcher's done. We should do that here. And now, especially Marine Le Pen has a much more, left approach to, economics and, social safety nets. And so he's also a voice for that within the party, who has fewer negatives. Florian Philippot has fewer negatives than Alain Soral had, because Alain Soral, he lost out in the, you know, de-diabolisation, like the undemonizing of the party, right? He's just too controversial of a character, and he was eventually sidelined, you know, as they try to make themselves respectable in polite company, you know. And yeah, Florian Philippot exactly has precisely the same economic views as Alain Soral, but he's just acceptable in polite company, you know.
That's interesting. How popular or unpopular is being anti-EU in France?
So it is not the majority position of the people, and I can't tell you how many times, and then, you know, this is again like talking about, you know, just random people in the street, right? Or you hand out a flyer to somebody or whatever, or you talk to somebody about the problem of immigration, and, you know, from the Arab world in particular, and they will say, oh yeah, you know, but she's wrong about Europe, and this will be the reason now why they won't vote for her. And it seems to be, you know, I don't know if these people who are with her on every other major issue, or who realize she's the only person standing against, you know, globalization and replacement of people, you know, would they ever vote for her, and this is just an excuse, or is it really that important to them? But it's hard to say. It's hard to say. But they're ignoring the fact that a president does not have the power to break treaties, that she would have to put this forward as a referendum. This is an example of where there's a disconnect between the people within the party you have to please to keep them active and working, because there are a lot of people who feel very passionate about getting rid of the euro and the FN, and the 50% of the people you need to vote for you on election day. So yeah, that's definitely a tension that we'll be facing going forward, and hopefully by, you know, I don't know if she's passionate about this issue as well, so I don't know if she can sideline it as much and say, okay, this will be a referendum, and always couch it in those terms. But there are, you know, maybe things will change in the next couple of years, because there are openings, I think, in the ways that this can be criticized. In one of the surprise regions where the FN won first place, it's the Loire Valley, which is a very rural area, famous for its beautiful castles and great white wine. And the guy who won by criticizing, it was a place where the FN really had a position that they were taking that no other party was taking, right? Because the center right, everyone expects them to try and sell out the French farmer to the United States and free trade agreements, right? And to Monsanto and so on. You know, they fear this is coming down the road. Now, with the Socialist Party and the Greens, they have very little interest in maintaining the level of employment in the rural areas. They're very urban focused. And they also, you know, they spend a lot of money on promoting organic foods. And I watched a presentation, which, you know, I try to eat as organic as much as I can. I'm sure, you know, you do as well. But when I watched a debate that the FN candidate who won was participating in, he said, look, 1/3 of our agricultural subsidies are going to 3 to 5% of our farmers, depending on the year, because 1/3 are earmarked for organic. And he said, no, if we're concerned about the desertification of rural areas and low employment in these areas, you know, maybe we should rethink that, the way we balance that out, you know, and it should be based not on, you know, some kind of ideology that we split the cake, you know, it should be based on what are the needs of the people in this area. And it's very much, you know, he talked very little about the refugee crisis, actually. This is Philippe Loiseau in the early, you know, Loire Valley area. And he spoke really about bread and butter issues that touched the vast majority of people there. And I think that's the, I mean, when it comes to these local elections, that's definitely the way to go. And there was definitely worked for him in the first round. I think he got about, I don't know if it was 36% that he got, but, you know, he did not pull ahead, unfortunately. He would have needed to make great gains in the second round, which is very hard for an FN candidate. But he did, I think his performance was based on this kind of bread and butter approach and only attacking the EU in very specific ways, you know, like this, in this way that they affect, you know, local agriculture, this is wrong. Not the whole concept of the EU, because people still remember the First and Second World War, and they see this as their only hope for preventing such a thing.
Yeah. Right, right. I think that it's very important for the Front National. If I were Marine Le Pen or advising her, I would emphasize that, yes, we don't want any more European fratricidal wars.
Yeah.
And that really the only objection to the EU is that it's not actually working to secure Europe. It's actually working to undermine Europe by opening the borders to Africa and the Muslim world. And therefore it's, you know, it's preventing Europeans from fighting with one another, but it's also destroying Europe. And therefore we need to change it. We need something better. In terms of sovereignty issues, I do think that the best way, region by region, is, as you said, to emphasize the political issues where the local interests conflict with the EU, where sovereignty would be better for farmers, or better for fishermen, or better for mothers, or better for whatever group in whatever area you're talking about. Years ago, I think it was in 2008, a friend of mine who was really into Ron Paul, I think he actually went and bought a billboard himself in the Atlanta area, or at least he was talking about it. The details are hazy. But the things he wanted on the billboard were close the border, save the dollar, stop the war, Ron Paul. And I said, you know, that's good, intelligent retail politics, because the three most important things that any politician can deliver to the average voter are prosperity, save the dollar, security, close the border, and peace and the war. And if the Front National can, region by region, city by city, block by block, go out and show people that they have a vision of France where they can better secure prosperity, security, and peace for the citizenry, then they're going to be able to win. How much experience, though, do Front National people have in government, and how much of their vote depends upon really protests against the existing establishment?
So very little. There are only a handful of municipalities that are under Front National control, and only since the most recent election. In the municipal elections. So those happened on one day or two, you know, two Sundays across the whole country, just like the regionals, just like the departmentals. And so other than that, there's really no experience in being in charge. Now, it's very easy to be in opposition because you're just, you know, tossing bombs, you know, just insulting the people and pointing out their flaws and what goes wrong. I was very hopeful to see them have at least one or two regions so they can point to experience governing, because, you know, the average voter is not ideological. We're not going to convince them of our ideology between now and then. They are very, very practical, and they want to see, think about it this way. The next time you're in a room with a bunch of people who, you know, think like us, imagine inviting somebody off the street and saying, you know, what do you think about everyone here taking over, you know, the water, the trash, and the roads for your local area. And because that's, and the reaction you're going to get is going to be a typical reaction. You know, is that they're going to be very practical about who they want to govern them. And so, you know, it's really unfortunate there's nowhere they can point to and say, here's our success, here's what Front National values look like when transformed into policy. However, it also means that when they're running in the next election, that the opposition will be running against a phantom. All they're going to be able to do is talk about World War II and about, you know, deportation of Jews and all these kinds of things. In fact, in this last election, somebody leaked all of the newsletters that were sent out, I guess, or flash faxes or whatever sent out by the French version of the ADL. And almost all of them made reference to Vichy and deportations and these kinds of things. And saying that, you know, implying that this would happen under the FN.
That's really all they have anymore, isn't it?
That's all they got. And so, I mean, think about, I guess, for you, like, how much did World War I play a role in developing your political worldview? You know, I mean, and okay, now for a 20-year-old, how much is World War II going to. You know, they may have seen a couple of Spielberg movies, but, you know, it's just not going to have the same weight that it had for the previous generation.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, one thing, I guess I'll go through a few numbers as well. I should point out, though, I talked about Philippe Loiseau. He actually only got 30% in the Loire Valley, and who was one of the people who was number one. Another one was Sophie Montel, who is, definitely one of these, neither left nor right, but a Front National, we're anti-globalist sort of people. Her roots are in, in terms of politics, we're in actually fighting for animals and animal rights and this kind of thing. And she's a dental surgeon. She got in trouble for agreeing with, Jean-Marie Le Pen, years ago that, there are differences between the races and that they're not equal. And she was number one in her region in the east of France. Florian Philippot was number one in the Alsace and to parts west of there, right? This other eastern region. And, his was very much focused on, the refugee crisis and immigration because they border Germany. Right. And actually, there are a lot of people in the Alsace who speak German. So, for them, that's, they're a frontline region. And so for them, that's a big issue. If you were to go to the Loire Valley and talk about this, or in the Southwest where they border Spain and where, Louis Alliot won, that's just not an issue there. Right. Everyone really focused on what was best for their region. Marine Le Pen, she's in a Rust Belt area in the north of France. And also an area where, in Calais, which is where the jungle is, where you have this collection of people, waiting to cross over to Britain. You know, there it was a combination of the refugee crisis and the clash of civilizations to a certain extent, not from a neocon worldview, but a very non-kosher worldview. And it was also, a left approach to economics.
Industrial policy.
Yes, exactly. Whereas her niece in the south, which is a much wealthier area, doesn't talk about this whatsoever. And is, it's not an industrial part of France, the southwest, southeast France. And never was. I mean, you have a couple ports there, but it's, a lot of tourism, trade, I would probably, these would be the top two and maybe 50% of the economy there, right?
So they are very intelligently addressing the concerns of each region by region. It's not some kind of one-size-fits-all ideological boiler suit political campaign. That's actually very encouraging.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess I could jump into some of the numbers here as well for them between the first and the second round, which was really interesting. And I was, I saw the numbers at 5 p.m. Traditionally, they release the participation level, right? There's no exit polling that's shown on television. I think it's illegal, actually, to show exit polling on TV. But at 5 p.m. in every election, they say this is the turnout. And I saw a big rise in turnout in the second tour, and that made me concerned, because typically the FN doesn't have that many votes in reserve. One of the reasons, to turn back the clock to the legislatives, which came right after the presidential election in 2012, Marine Le Pen only won two seats with her group, but she was very, very happy. And the reason why she was so happy was that she could see the numbers that they gained so many socialists, maybe one third of socialists when they were fighting against the right. If it's center right versus the FN, the FN is going to get one third of the socialists who have no one to vote for. And so that was a huge, huge move in the right direction. That was thanks to her new approach to electioneering. And this time, it wasn't as bad as I expected, but so the average participation rate for a second round election where the FN was the leading party was 53.4%. And then the average vote participation in a region that did not have the FN as number one was 48%. So a 5% difference in people turning out to vote if the FN was there. And that included both people who were for and against. Now, it was a bit more, probably about, 40, 60 for the FN against the FN who turned out. For Marine Le Pen, she had 36% of the second tour votes and of the new votes, let's say, new people showing up, she got 36% of those. And in the first election, when it was just seven parties going against each other, she got 40%. So it was slightly under, because the idea that you'll see in the press, the reason why I mentioned that number is that when you see the FN as the number one party amongst the youth, what they'll do when they present this in the media sometimes is they'll say, like, well, you have so many youth staying home. Actually, it's not really 40% of the youth that votes for the FN. It's really only 12% of the youth that votes for the FN. And they make the assumption that, well, every other young person out there must be a socialist or a communist or maybe a central rightist. And it's just that these FN, you know, extremists are just so motivated to go out and vote, right? These kind of results show that that's not the case, that there are people who stay home and only vote in the second tour who are FN supporters, right? And in fact, in the case of Marielle Le Pen, she got half of the new voters who came out in the second tour.
And that's great. Yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, you know, I mentioned earlier the blank vote. 5.4% voted blank in the South for Marielle Le Pen's election, and almost 5% in the North in Marine Le Pen's election. Which means that these are people on the far left, most likely, who the socialists told, go out there and vote for a center-right guy. And they said, you know, basically gave them the salute, you know, underarm salute, you know, and went out and they voted a blank ticket. Because that's what that exists for. But, you know, and 5%, you know, these are numbers similar to what happened in the Marine Le Pen presidential election, right? When she told the FN voters, go out there and vote blank. It was slightly more then, but it was about a third. Here's the other thing that was interesting. It was about a third of the FN supporters from the presidential who went out and voted blank when they were told to. And in terms of the socialists, however, are even more loyal, unfortunately, because it was about 80% who went out and voted for the right.
Wow.
Yeah. And 20% either stayed home or voted blank. So, and in fact, even if one third in the South, even if one third of the left had went for, you know, voted blank, it wouldn't have been enough to throw the election for Marielle Le Pen, unfortunately. So it's going to be it was very exhilarating to see them come in first place. But at the same time, you know, it's hard to jump from 30% or 40% up to 50%. When you're such a demonized party as the FN.
Right. But it generally, I think, represents progress, real progress. Now, let me ask you, how seriously are these elections taken by the French? Is it an important election for them, or is it just like, you know, a school board election?
Yeah, the least important election would be the European elections, in terms of how people feel about them, and the most important would be the presidential.
And the FN does really well in the European elections because there's so little at stake.
Correct, correct. Yeah, the voting public will take chances, I think. And also because there haven't been systems of client-patron relationships set up.
Right,
like exactly. There are in municipal elections. And that really matters a lot. I think that's something that's ignored a lot in politics, in commentary, but it really matters a lot. And that's why you find places that will vote for Marine Le Pen in the presidential election who have socialist mayors, right? Because they're, they bring home the bacon, right? That kind of thing. Yeah.
Right, right. Yeah. I'm so glad that the FN has set aside Thatcherism, basically, because if they're going to win, they're going to have to do right-wing populism, and that means Christmas gooses and political patronage, machine politics. That's got to happen. And they've got to roll up their sleeves and just do that. If they ever get in power in a municipality, they've got to deliver.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I think there were there are two things that I heard. I guess one main thing I heard on a show called Morning Joe on MSNBC. That's a guy named Joe Scarborough, who used to be a congressman from Georgia, I believe. And he was part of the Gingrich crowd, right, back in the 90s. And he's there with the daughter of Zbigniew Brzezinski. And it's interesting every now and then, especially in elections, because here's a guy one of the few on TV who's actually done it himself. And I feel like there are some insights that he shares that you know, you don't hear a lot elsewhere. And they were talking, this was back in 2012, they were talking about Rick Santorum, who is really the standard bearer of the Catholic Rite in the United States, right? And he had said something about, questioning whether birth control had been a good thing for women all the way, or whether there had also been bad things that came along with it, right? And this set Republican women into a fit. You know, they're like, what's happening? Is he going to take away, you know, birth control? And the media was definitely pile on and making it, you know, and making it seem like he's going to take away their birth control and so on. And Scarborough was saying, like, look, you know, when you're a guy like Santorum and you've got, you know, a couple of Senate terms behind you and you have this real rapport with this particular highly engaged but also marginalized group of voters, all you have to do is look at them and, you know, he winked and he gave a thumbs up and he's like, hey guys, if I win, you win. And that's all you got to do. You have to go out there and be a normal candidate and you have to, you know, work your way to 50% and reach towards the middle, right? And he failed to do that. He said he had the heart of an activist and he had the, of a philosopher, but not of a politician. And Ed Rendell, who was the former Philadelphia mayor, former Pennsylvania governor, was also on the panel, and he was governor when Santorum was senator. And he refused to say anything bad about Santorum. And he said that when he was in the Senate, we would always talk. He always wanted to know, you know, how we could work together to put, you know, to do different things for Pennsylvania. And he always brought home the bacon. He just knew how to do it. And it shows you how important, you know, that is as well to the, to the inside game of politics, right? I think that conversation was something that was really illustrates something that's key, that they have to, you know, look at some of their more extreme elements within the party and kind of give them a thumbs up and say, all right, if we win, you win. And it's very hard to do because there's a lot of lost trust between, you know, certain strains of nationalists and the FN. I mean, she is really at this point the only hope for political reform. The good news, I guess, from this defeat, if there is any, is that they still got 6 million votes, or over 6 million votes in this regional election, both in the first round and the second round. So both when they had candidates all across the country and then when they were in striking distance of power in certain regions in the second vote. That's about the same number that she had in the presidential election. But the difference is that in the presidential election, you had 36 million voters, and in the regional election, you had 22 million voters. So between now and 17 months from now, there were 14 million people or so who stayed at home this last election cycle. And Marine Le Pen only needs about 3 to 5 million of them in order to make it to the second round. Less than a quarter, maybe, will be enough to make it to the second round in the presidential election.
And she's done better than a quarter before, so that's very encouraging, yeah.
Yeah, it's very encouraging. So I think that, you know, her in the second tour is very, very likely. I think that's something that she can, frankly, you know, people will be red-pilled by reality. You know, that will be, it'll be a few months after the refugees that are currently being processed start arriving. Who knows if there will be another African crisis coming across Italy and into southern France.
There will definitely be more terrorist attacks.
There will be more terror. Yeah, exactly. More.
I'm surprised that people haven't been massacred while out Christmas shopping yet this season, like last season.
I'm sure that's coming.
It's coming. Yeah.
And the other thing is, there needs to be she'll have a better chance running against the Socialist Party in the second round than the center right. And so, one thing that's also really nice to see is that the only charismatic person in the leftist front, which was kind of, you know, anti-racist, anti-liberal, socialist plus the Communist Party, joined together in a coalition. The only charismatic person amongst them was Jean-Luc Mélenchon. And he has been essentially on permanent vacation since summer of 2014. And the party has suffered greatly for it. In the Paris region, they only got 6.6% of the vote. In Normandy, they got 7%. And in every other region within France, they got less than 5%. So they will most likely not be a factor in the first round. And left-wing voters will be voting for the Socialist Party. And in fact, the person who was more pro, peace, the Communist Party, pro Front de Gauche in the ecologist, in the Green Party, right? She is no longer the leader of the Green Party. And it's now someone who's more pro an alliance with the socialist. So if they get into, we'll see the direction that goes in, but, that looks like the left will be more unified than it was last time and the time before coming up soon. The Republicans, as they call themselves now, the center-right party, will have a primary for, I believe, the first time in their history to choose their presidential candidate. Before, they had planned on having it in November of next year. They've actually moved it back now to, I think it's going to be in May, perhaps. I think they haven't even set a date. They are just saying, we need to move it back earlier. Now, Sarkozy has not presented himself yet to run in this primary. He may. The woman who lost the mayoral race for Paris, it's Nathalie Kouzko-Morizet. It's a Jewish woman. She's already presented herself. Nadine Morano, who is a lady who said that France is a country of the white race and Christian heritage, has also presented herself. And I think François Fillon has also already presented himself. Now, Fillon is different from Sarkozy and from Copé, who was in charge of the party after Sarkozy left briefly, and from Moise, and that he's actually a Catholic and a French guy, right? Not a Jewish guy. He has also softened his anti-FN stance over the years. Now, he's never said that we should have an alliance with him, but he doesn't go along with the Sarkozy, vote for the socialist rather than the FN call, right? And also he was Sarkozy's number two when Sarkozy was president. He had tried to shed light on a particular scandal at Sarkozy's. And it was thought that he was just trying to take his boss's position, right, by people in that party. And that's why he was sidelined. But I have to imagine that he's got a lot of personal animus against the clique of Jews and half-Jews who are running the party. And he's got some differences of opinion with them as well, that he can put some window dressing on his personal vendettas with the voters. And if he loses this, and if it's Sarkozy, especially, or if it's a fairly terrible candidate like Nathalie Kouzko-Morizet, he could present himself as well. And that would really divide the center-right. And that would really help getting it into the situation where it's Marine Le Pen versus the socialists. So, and in fact, 40% of card-carrying UMP members want to have deals cut with the FN to be a part of a ruling coalition.
40%, that's significant. Wow.
Yeah, but you won't find a single leader in a leadership position in the party who goes along with that 40%. So this is just a crowd waiting for a leader to jump out in front of it. There are places like Denmark and now in Austria where the Nationalist Party is a necessary element of a right-wing coalition government. And that may one day be the case in France. Will they have the courage to do what's necessary to protect a French majority, a European majority within France? I'm not sure. But I think that there are people who can look to these other countries within the center-right and see that it's not a horrible thing to team up. However, though, after this last regional election, I think that the lesson is that the lesson that the pragmatist within the center-right will take is that let's keep doing what we've always been doing. Because the last regional election, if the FN and the center-right had made a coalition, they would have had one third of the regions, right? With the UMP in charge in every single one of those one thirds, they would be the senior partner, right? Instead, they only had 1 out of 22. So they settled for 1 out of 22 rather than that.
Hmm, that's fascinating. Well, they do have principles, don't they?
They do.
Unfortunately, their principles are the principles of the enemy.
Yeah. This time around, if they made a coalition, though, I mean, they would have been the senior member of a coalition in, I think maybe one extra. They would have gained one extra region, perhaps. But they would have been the senior member in all but two or three of them, you know. And they would, you know. And the socialists would have only carried, I think, I looked at the numbers earlier today. I think it was like 3 out of the 12, right? So, you know, they would have gained maybe control over, you know, rural trash pickup and high school spending in two or three regions that they don't have control of now. But they would have gained also the ire of the most powerful ethnic lobby in France, which is the Jewish lobby, right? And all of the levers of power that they hold in the media and finance, which obviously, you know, and from a pure survival point of view, which a lot of these political leaders have, they made the right decision, right? But I think that, hopefully, you know, that level, that kind of, logic and calculus that they've engaged in will not work in the environment we'll find ourselves in the near future.
Exactly. Well, let's wrap this up, but I would like to talk about our Marine Le Pen, namely Donald Trump, briefly. You had a really interesting idea, and I'd like to sort of put this out there as marching orders, if you will, to our listeners. Take a page from the people who created the white student unions. Go out and create a Facebook page for Students for Trump. We need to have a Students for Trump movement. And can you explain the rationale for that?
Sure. In fact, it's even beyond Facebook. I know that tomorrow night is the debate, and we've got 5 different universities where there will be debate-watching parties going on, right? And these will be organized by, you know, a racial nationalist like one of us, who will not be sharing his controversial views with the people who attend, but just be the indispensable volunteer with the Trump supporters there and organize them and keep track of who's there. And, you know, maybe it starts out with just fun parties, this kind of thing, developing into maybe one day putting out flyers or something like this, right? And then our person there will determine who's able of actually, you know, to actually act, right? Not just talk. And then after Trump loses, which I believe is inevitable, about one third of these supporters, they'll probably fall in line with whoever the Republican nominee is. And maybe one third will just disappear. But I think that one third will probably be very angry. And for a couple months, will start thinking outside the box. And that's the time to then share some of our views with them and to draw them into some of our activities and to increase our numbers, because the biggest boon, I think, has been the collapse of the Ron Paul movement for us, you know, and people who are saying, okay, why was Ron Paul not given a fair shake? Why didn't the media give him a chance to make his case? You know, why was he, yeah, why did that happen? And then when they start to, you know, pull the thread a bit harder and they see who's behind the media, then they can only turn to white nationalism and to an awareness of the Jewish problem. And so I think that'll happen with the Trump supporters as well.
I think so too. He's already pushed the Overton window. He's already put previously undiscussable topics back out there in public discourse.
Yeah.
None of that's going to disappear anytime soon. And I think he really is like he's like an icebreaker plowing through the frozen over crust of American politics and creating a space that we can move in behind. And whether he wins or loses, whether he gets the nomination or not, whether he wins the presidency or not, all of that metapolitical change that he's created is a positive, And yeah. We'd really need to be there to especially reap the benefits if he is locked out of the nomination or loses the presidency. Then people get really angry.
Right. He's got the money, and I believe he's got the will to stick it out until the end in the primary process. And if he does, and if he's winning 30% steadily, state after state, and if you're seeing a divided field winning, you know, if it's, oh, Chris Christie's winning the Northeast and Kasich's winning the Midwest and, you know, and Ted Cruz is winning the South and the Southwest, then there's going to be a smoke-filled room in the back of the Republican convention, and Trump will come out the loser.
Yes, and then I hope he runs as a third-party candidate.
Yeah.
And guts the Republicans.
Oh, absolutely. And whether he does or not, then I think that, you know, that's going to be a real red pill moment for a lot of people watching.
Yeah.
You know, especially if it could be very similar to what we're seeing in France now. You know, when 40% of an electorate are told that they are bringing civil war, Manuel Valls said that actually, said that a vote for them is, you know, these are people who want to bring civil war into France. There is in fact, a doctor in Normandy who posted on his Facebook after commenting on a news article. He was very, so proud of himself. He put it on his personal Facebook calling for the rape of nationalist females. And he said, even better if it's by a black or an Arab. You know, this is the, and then this 40% of the electorate is then blocked by the most nefarious means from having their voice in the halls of power heard. You know, I think that, you know, they're going to go from being a mild supporter, quite a few of them, to being a more passionate supporter. And people on the fence are going to say, whoa, there's something about the rules of the game here that's not quite fair. And why is that? That can only lead them to us. We are the only people who provide a paradigm to understand the power structure of the world. It's not the Illuminati. It's not, you know, wasps in the white shoe law firms. It's not, lizard aliens. You can only go to a combine of the organized Jewish community and the oligarchs, using immigration and destruction of our civilization like pawns in a game. And, that's the only explanation. That's the only paradigm that can be consistently give you an understanding of the power structure today.
Well, Patrick, thank you very much. This has been a very good conversation, and I hope that we will be seeing in the near future Students for Trump groups popping up all over the virtual world and then materializing in the real world and actually making a difference. So absolutely. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I guess I'll say one last thing. You know, they can write to nodenyingit@yandex.com. That's no denying it with no dashes or periods. And then yandex.com if they need any help and advice or logistics on how to do this.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Have a good one.